The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 5th of February, 2021. On the podcast today, Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Energy, discusses the 7-year new gas sales agreement they've signed with Mulek Energy. Also on the podcast are Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare at SP Angel. And we discuss, gets a little bit heated points, COVID testing stocks. And we talk about Novacyt in there, of course. And there's a couple of others we mentioned. I think we mentioned Mega and Abingdon Health. Also, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the silver short, negative interest rates and dividends. Plus, as always on the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most read RNSs too. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We will see a plethora, a host, a bunch of content there. Silence Therapeutics raises $45 million to advance drug pipeline. There's an article by Fran right there. There's also one on Savannah Energy we've just talked about. There's a My Health Check elevator pitch. Check that out. Tech Capital sees investor backing for Microsoft. And, of course, our COVID-19 index. Biggest rise of the day is E Therapeutics, up 11.11%, 24 pence. Biggest faller, Cromec Group, down 5% to 20.5 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Energy. S-A-V-E is ticker there, save. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Justin. Much appreciated.
Yeah, that's quite appropriate, I suppose, save, because in your RNS today, you talk about customer benefits, including a 40% saving. And we'll talk about this this agreement you've got with Mulek Energy in a bit. Before we do, as always, Andrew, if someone's listening right now or not familiar with Savannah Energy, just explain the company, if you could, please.
Okay, so Savannah is a high-growth, high-margin, West African-focused energy company. We are active with two business units, one in Nigeria, one in Niger. In Nigeria, we supply over 10% of the gas which to the country's power infrastructure. And in Niger, we're part of a wider project which over time we anticipate could increase the country's GDP by over 50%. So both projects are really matter, and they're material for the countries in which we operate. In terms of, to give you an idea of the scale of our business, we have about $4.3 billion of contracted revenues, which span out for the next 17 years. The growth rate we delivered in revenues last year was 23% year on year. We more than doubled our cash balance, which reduced our leverage from 3.3 times to 2.2 times. And the revenues have been delivered at a very high margin. So we're currently doing about an 80%. EBITDA margin.
Wow.
So the base case business is moving ahead very strongly. And then we have another business unit in Niger where we've drilled five exploration wells. We've had five discoveries. We have a bank of over 140 further structures that we've identified to consider future drilling activity on. And a clear low cost plan to start developing that crude into existing infrastructure. So we have a good cash flow generating engine in Nigeria. We expect to complement that with cash flow generation in Niger. And in both countries, we see very strong growth.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the news today. Your subsidiary, AccuGas, has entered into a new gas sales agreement with Mulek Energy. Can you take us through this, Andrew, if you could?
Yeah, okay. So in the southeast of Nigeria, we have the only gas transportation and distribution network in that part of the country. So when it comes to people wanting gas or seeking gas, we have to be in the conversation unless someone wants to spend a very large amount of money replicating our infrastructure. And that replication cost is over $1 billion. So the economy of Nigeria, Nigeria is the continental champion. It's the largest, it has the largest GDP in Africa, and has also has a very high underlying population and GDP growth rate. So the demand for what we do is rising, and we have a strong infrastructure position to enable us to take advantage of that growing demand, in our opinion. We currently sell gas to three customers, two power stations and a cement factory. And that's what gives us that very, very strong base load of cash flows, the $4.3 billion minimum we've got contracted for the next 17 years. And then we've signed a third power station contract, which we expect to become active over the course of the coming months. And then this morning, it's really exciting, we signed a deal, which is the first time we've done a deal. I think it's the first time that you've seen it in Nigeria done domestically, whereby we're going to sell our gas for CNG. The customer that we're working with is a company called Mulac Energy. Mulac has the Caterpillar franchise in Nigeria. What that means is they currently supply diesel-fired power generation to a variety of customers throughout Nigeria, amounting to over 400 megawatts. We have signed a deal initially to work with them to start to help them replace their diesel fire generation with CNG fire generation, which has the benefits for their customers of significantly reducing the cost of the power and significantly reducing the carbon footprint that they have. So the market size over time of what we've announced this morning is clearly very significant. And the pricing that we expect to get is extremely robust. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it's just what we set out over the last couple of years is a series of milestones that we do. We would sign new gas sales agreements, et cetera, et cetera. This is one of the new gas sales agreements. I would be confident that we'll be able to announce more gas sales agreements as we move on throughout the year. But really, this is a very exciting one because of the caliber of the customer, because of the potential growth in the CNG market. We're very happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. It's all going in the right direction by the sound of it, Andrew. So if people are listening right now or liking the sound of this, but not yet follow the story, just give them those three quick bullet reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please, Andrew.
So, I think the first issue would be the quality and the purpose of the businesses that we have. Both businesses are very high quality, and they're doing something which makes a real difference in the countries in which they operate. So that would be the first point. The second point is the high growth, high margin nature of what we're doing, and that we believe we're able to sustain that high growth, high margin as we push out into the future. And then the last point I would say is that you can look back and you can see what's been delivered, which should give you confidence around what we're trying to do into the future. So I'd say it's the quality, it's the profitability and growth that we've been able to achieve, and it's the track record.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Andrew, good to chat to you. And like I say, lots going on there, so hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
I definitely expect to be, Justin. Thank you so much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, Head of Healthcare, SP Angel. You're right, Vadim?
How are you doing, Justin?
Good, thanks. Do you know what? I think the landscape is changing. And I mentioned a while back, I said, if the vaccines are successful and they're rolling out successfully, and hospital admissions are going down. And in fact, I don't know if you saw very encouraging data. First of all, we got encouraging data from our side, over 10 million vaccinations, and hospital admissions have gone down almost 2,300 per day. That was above 4,000 recently. And so, yeah. But in Israel, which of course they're more advanced, the smaller population, but they're more advanced in the vaccination program, one of the few countries that are, but they come out with news, vaccine data shows extremely low rates of infection. So only 0.04% of people caught the virus a week after second dose, and only 0.002% needed hospital treatment. So you can see over there, it's very effective. They're having hardly any more hospital admissions after the second dose. And I'm thinking, if that happens over there, because they're using the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine there, so are we, and the AstraZeneca one, which they've done more tests on that. Is it successful? Will they need to? I can't see testing happening en masse still. I mean, I know Novacyt has knocked it out of the park already. They're there, done it, the money's in the bank. But will they need, a lot of testing going forward now if the vaccines are working, if they are working?
Yeah, so definitely all very good news on the vaccines. We are past this peak, as Chris Whitty said the other day. The numbers are coming down very quickly in terms of new infections in London, which is great. The vaccines are showing also the AstraZeneca vaccine, some good news. Last week was good news on vaccines, right? So we had the Novavax vaccine news, positive news there. This week, what we had is some scientific evidence or early evidence of vaccine slowing transmission, particularly the AstraZeneca vaccine, right? So all this is all very good news. And you're right, Israel's being, a couple of months ahead in terms of vaccination. So, and we're catching up pretty quickly, because I'd say we're probably second in terms globally in terms of rolling out vaccines. So it's all starting to kick in and working, right? Mm-hmm. So that's good. What does that mean in terms of our general overview of, so that's vaccine positive for the vaccine manufacturers. And as you and I have always, suggested, that there will be kind of a day of re-rating on some of these diagnostic stocks, because it's at some level, it's testing negative. So as in negative for testing manufacturers, right? Mm. But the reality is that there is this, it's trying to decide, first of all, what the new normal will be, because testing will re-rate to a new normal, which is much higher, okay, than prior to the COVID crisis, and that new normal might be a lot higher than we expect, okay. And then it's the trajectory of where we are in peak testing to that new normal. What is the timing of that, okay? And we believe that it's this year, but it will be a decreasing kind of. Probably around somewhere halfway through the year, downwards towards the end of the year, to that new normal, and then maybe even into next year. Now, and there's many different calls on that. Sometime in 21, we'll see the peak of testing start to go down, okay? Because peak testing is very difficult to justify financially, because it's so expensive, right? Mm-hmm. As in, you can't do peak level testing indefinitely, you'll bankrupt any government, right? But I think the UK has a 22 billion up to 46 billion plan. So, there's a lot of money still in the space, and testing will continue. So, I completely agree with you. It was always about trying to call, and no one has a crystal ball on this. It's very difficult to assess, right? Mm. But trying to call what the difference, the delta between peak levels are and the new normal levels. And we'll talk about that in a sec, what the new normal might look like in the future, okay? Yeah. And when it starts to go down and how quickly it goes down. And some believe that tail will start to go down much slower. I think it's somewhere in between. It'll come down pretty quickly over the next 18 months at some point to a new normal that's probably higher than we expect. Now, by then, there's other issues that will kick in. So there's competition. We mentioned that. Many tests are coming onto market. So the market is getting really competitive. So that means that margins will start coming down as well. That's another element. If you're not coming up with new tests, and that's where, players like Novacyt were always ahead, and they have a pipeline of new products coming through, and they have their installed base of machines that's still growing. And that installed base of machines allows you to put new product on top. So the future of companies like Novacyt is, they've gone from small cap to mid cap, and they're, I hope to see them stay as a mid cap with a suite of new products coming on stream. Why? Because they're plowing a lot of that cash into R&D, and development times are much faster than in pharma. So you can turn around products pretty quickly, and they've demonstrated that they've done that historically. It's kind of the smaller players I'm a bit more worried about. We've said this before, Omega, Gene Drives, although Gene Drive had a contract recently, had a good rally, which is good. That's good to see. Abingdon has had some issues recently. There are other smaller ones like that that are more exposed, and maybe are far more overvalued, than a Novacyt, for example, which is trading on 2x or 3x revenue. You know what I mean? Or 2x revenue, actually, because they just put out a trading statement long ago. showing that they did about 300 million euros in revenues last year, which is phenomenal, you know?
Yeah.
But anyways, like, my main point is that, yeah, at some point in this year, we will probably be surprised back and forth. And if you look at the volatility of those shares, they're huge. So what I would say to you is, you know, sometimes buy on big troughs. If you want to trade these stocks, they're good. They provide huge trading opportunities. Buy on the trough, you know, when they fall, because they move 20-30% sometimes, you know, within a week. And it's proven to be successful. I don't trade these stocks, but I just, if you had that trading strategy, you would have come out a pretty big winner, because they move 20-30-40%, and then they come back that amount on a mistake in that calculation that we just said. You know, the crisis has gone on a bit longer. Everyone got caught. Everyone thought testing was coming down. They all got caught out. All those stocks went back up. You know, if you just look at the share prices of Novacyt, Gene Drive, you know, they've all gone up and down, up and down. And now they're kind of in a, you know, down mode. And I think there's going to be another surprise in terms of, you know, testing. I think you might see governments slightly slowing, but you might have other places which might emerge, like travel, for example. You know, travel testing is probably going to come on stream pretty. So private payer testing is probably going to come on stream pretty aggressively in the next little while.
Yeah. But I think what people are saying, people are buying Novacyt now, saying it's undervalued. And I think what people are missing out on is the stock market is about the future. You know, it's about future revenues and the foresight you have there. And now they did 210 million euros of EBITDA, so they're valued now at market cap 570 million. So they are undervalued on traditional metrics. Of course they are. But this is the company now where people realise they've made hay while the sun is shining. That sun is not going to be as bright going forward, and they've done very well at it. The sun isn't going to be as bright, is it? Because, of course, testing is going to go down. I mean, I genuinely think, of course, they'll have testing, like you said, private testing probably, but not like at government level where they're ordering 500,000.
For sure.
The UK doing 500,000 tests a day, you know? That's a huge amount. It's not going to be like that anymore. I even think if vaccinations, and we've had data out showing they are very effective, even first dose from AstraZeneca is what, 76%, I think, effective, and it lasts for 3 months. 82% with two jabs. So if it's proven over and over again that they are that effective, I don't think testing will be around for long. So that's way above flu efficacy, and we carry on with that, those vaccinations, without mass testing. So I just genuinely think that's why Novacyt isn't valued as it should, well, as it would be, because if they had this revenue coming every year, it would, of course it would, but it's not. It was an exceptional year for them, 2020, and it probably won't be like that going forward, will it, you know?
Well. So that's the question, right? So the question for all of us is, when is testing going to come off, and by how much? And so far, everyone's had it wrong 10 times over. Do you know what I mean? And that's why the volatility of these stocks it keeps going up and down. So nobody expected the second, third wave. You know what I mean? Nobody expected the variants.
I'm just worried that the people are thinking that Novacyt is going to boom again like crazy, and I look at the chart, it's a double top there. I don't know if it will. I don't know if it will go back. I mean, technically it may have another attempt, but I think fundamentally, like I say, are they going to have such a good year as they did last year? I don't know if they are, you know? That's it. Simple as that, you know?
Well, so okay. Absolutely fair question. And I think where really the difficulty is in some of the smaller, more speculative plays that haven't established themselves. You know what I mean? Novacyt's already moving on to the next story of you know, producing other diagnostic tests, you know, broadly in infectious diseases, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I think that's worth talking about just in general about what the future is going to look like, right? So do you think we're going to go back to a world where we don't do viral testing, period? You just go back to hoping that people get better from the flu, and, you know, everything is, you know, every year we just hope the flu gets, you know, just as an example, the flu is just an example. But You think COVID, you know, that's it? We're never going to hear about COVID again?
Well, no, of course not. No. Absolutely not. No. What I'm saying is, though, we got better vaccines for COVID. The reason why we blew up, of course, is because we didn't have a vaccine. Now, it doesn't, for the majority of people, age under 60, it's not a problem. You get ill, yeah. But the problem is, of course, when you don't have a vaccine, you can't protect the old people who will be hospitalised, and you flood the NHS, and everyone else then gets affected, A&E, you know, all that, people with cancer treatments, all that get affected. That's why we need a vaccine urgently. That's why we're all rushing and scared and worried, because that's the rollover, the overflow. Yeah. Now, once we get an effective vaccines, and they're more effective than the flu, once they're in mass supply, there'll be no problem. We'll have a COVID every year. We'll have a people who are vulnerable will have a flu vaccine and a COVID vaccine. That's it. Most people won't have a COVID vaccine because they don't need one. Simple as that. Yeah. Same with flu. Most people don't need a flu. So once we get the supply on, you know, mass supply of these vaccines, because at the moment it's a bit lumpy because, of course, they're trying to ramp up from nothing to, you know, a billion doses. Once we get coming out, you know, flowing nicely, the supply of that, I just think there won't be that a problem. They're more effective than the flu vaccines, you know, so it's not a problem. Yeah. But it's around forever. It's here forever, you know. But we live with it.
But what I'm saying is exactly, I think, slightly different to that. And that's why it's worth talking about it, because it is, those are different views and no one really knows how it's all going to play out. My view is that testing, this is just not just a Novacyte thing. This is a global testing, step change. So infectious diseases have taken a far bigger priority in our lives now and have shown the world how dangerous they can be, right? So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we used to catch the flu and no one really ever got tested or cared, right? As another virus.
No, they did care when it first came out, didn't they? Because, of course, when it first comes out and you haven't got a vaccine for it, it kills millions of people. That's the problem. So then...
I'm talking about seasonal flu. I'm talking about seasonal flu, okay? You know, it would just rip through our population every year. And yes, we had the elderly taking vaccines.
No, but I mean, what I'm saying is, if you go back to like when it first came around, the flu, you know, when it first came out, there was no vaccine for it. It killed millions of people. And then there was a massive global pandemic, same as there is now with COVID. And so until you get a vaccine, you can't control it. But now we've got a vaccine so quickly, you can control the coronavirus. It'll never go away, but we'll control it, you know?
Yeah, but that's what I'm trying to say is that we previously didn't really test that much for seasonal flu. And now we're going to be testing for it a lot more.
It wasn't, was it, before?
Sorry?
We didn't have the tech did we before? In the 1920s, the flu came out. The technology wasn't there to test with back then, was it? On mass,
no, I'm talking about prior to this crisis. I think I'm comparing the flu today prior to COVID and post-COVID. So what's changed in the world is this: there's a bigger realization that we can actually test for all these viruses more routinely than we used to. The tests all existed for flu. Literally, I'm talking about the year before COVID, not in 2018, in 1918. I'm not talking about the flu, the influenza, Spanish influenza. I'm talking about annual testing for flu is going to go up substantially. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Why?
Why? Because people need to know what kind of virus they have when they come into A&E, vaccinated
New variants
come out. New variants come out every year of the flu. Mm. New variants come out every will start coming out every year of COVID, right?
Wouldn't they just be double vaccinated?
The world is changing, is what I'm trying to say. We won't have mass testing on the level that we're doing today, which we said earlier, right? But what I mean is that the world is going to change in how we look at infectious disease and testing for it, because we have the tools on hand.
So there's a higher level of testing going to go on generally, but probably not as high as it was.
It never will be as high as this. This is unaffordable.
Let me say one thing. Won't they just have, for vulnerable groups, a double vaccine? You know, literally COVID and flu. Don't need a test. You're in a vulnerable group. They'll just double vaccinate you, you know?
So I think what I expect to happen with COVID is similar to what's happened with the flu. We'll probably have annual. And the reason for that is because the virus has spread so globally.
Yeah, but what I mean about testing, they won't test so much. They won't need to test to find out what you've got. Because essentially what they'll do with the vulnerable groups anyway is just double vaccinate you. They'll vaccinate you for COVID and for flu. So they won't have to rather than just testing, because that's another layer of time and money spent, they'll just double vaccinate, won't they?
No, I think vaccines is the solution. Don't disagree with that at all. I just don't think that we're going to stop testing in hospitals when people come in with flu-like symptoms. I think we're going to, in fact, do the contrary. We're going to now be testing when we used to not test. You know what I mean? So someone comes in with a high fever, coughing into a hospital, from now on in, they're going to do respiratory panel tests. So they're going to check flu, coronavirus, and it's all one test, right? That's why it's called a respiratory panel. So you present with the same symptoms, and you might just have the common cold, like you might have the flu, like you might have a new variant of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And why we have vaccines, say, for two of them, and they've taken the edge out of killing, the most vulnerable. And yes, people may have been getting their second time getting COVID in 3 or 4 years' time and have a high fever. It's still dangerous. Some people won't be protected. New variants will emerge. That's what I mean by the new normal. The new normal is it'll become more like the flu, probably a bit more dangerous, but then less. It doesn't seem to mutate as quickly as the flu. So, mm-hmm. We're going to need new vaccines to solve these problems. We're also going to need regular testing. And just the reality is, I just think the new norm, I'm trying to paint a picture of what I think the new normal will look like. I don't think at all it'll be like the peak levels we're seeing today, but that new normal is very different from where we were prior to COVID for several viruses. So my point being is, for example, in the case of Novacyt, they've developed a respiratory panel. Other companies are doing the same. It's the trend because everyone is expecting that to be the new normal. Now, what level that new normal is very hard to tell, but it will be. You can imagine, hospitals testing for respiratory panels because it just makes sense. People, they don't want people coming in and not knowing what, how to take care of them, because how you take care of these patients, sorry, Justin, varies drastically with what virus they have. But mm-hmm. the symptoms that the person comes in with are very similar. You see what I mean? Whether you have flu, COVID, or something else. You're absolutely correct. Vaccines will be coming, rolling out. And, we just heard about the AstraZeneca plan for one of the variants, that it would take, weeks, months, not very long to come up with a vaccine against the new variant. So that will continue, just like we do with the flu. But because the pandemic was so big, and it infected so many people in so many different nations, we can expect more variants in the future. And that's why I think the new normal will be one where the world is far more capable now of dealing with multiple viruses and testing for them, admittedly at a much lower level, but still having to do it far more than we used to prior to this pandemic.
Yeah. So the companies, I think so Novacyt will still have a decent revenue stream probably, but not like it was.
Definitely. That's if you look at most of the forecasts, that's what they are. In fact, our forecasts are like that. We expect this year to be still pretty punchy because they're still running at peak levels today, right? Yeah. But eventually, yes, at some point we anticipate this year it'll come off. So we're talking about what month. That's very difficult to do, right? To forecast at what month the peak starts coming off, but it will, and for all the reasons you mentioned. And then the question is, what's the level? What's the kind of baseline level that is required?
I'll go back to my thought. If I invest in companies that will get better and better as the years come on, not questionable and maybe edging down, So that's why I wouldn't touch the testing stocks now, because I see them having a very patchy future. You can't really map it out. You don't know what level. You want growing. I want a company, invest in a company that's growing demand year on year. And you can't guarantee that with COVID testing stocks. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are many there that are very, that I completely agree with you, that are very, very, that aren't in that same position. They're not generating that huge amount of cash. They're not reinvesting into new different areas of infectious. We talk about infectious diseases. There's all these other tests that you can anticipate. We're going to be testing for many, many things far better, like MRSA. There's so many other problems out there that, need to be tested for more frequently. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I completely agree with you. It's the ones who have the cash that are plowing that cash back into either acquiring other technologies or acquiring other businesses or developing tests, in from their own R&D platforms. And then in the case, like say for Novacyt, I keep coming back to Novacyt because it's a good example of a company that's recycling that cash into doing, a lot of other things. Like for example, they have their Q16 and Q32 machines. It's like real estate. Once you get them out, you want to then put more tests on those machines, right? So that's what the DHSC contract that this company has had has allowed. It's allowed them to get that real estate out, and they have to broaden. They still have to. They have a long way to go globally to get those machines out. But my point being is, once you have that real estate of your installed base of the machines out there, then what you want to do is plow as much new tests onto it, COVID or not COVID. You know, anything. There's many areas in infectious diseases. The most intelligent one would be to go in these respiratory panels, because I really see in hospitals, I really see there being a need for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of stuff. Well, it's interesting. The future evolves, so it's interesting. We don't know what's really going on, but cool, marvelous, excellent stuff. Excellent, as always, Vadim. Thanks very much, fella, and we'll speak you next week.
Thanks, Justin. Speak soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ.
Yeah, I'm well. I'm in good health, thank you. Justin, are you okay?
Yes, all good. I'm saying, you know, we got a new dog in lockdown, one of the fads, but we're glad we did.
Lockdown dog.
Yeah, we're glad we did lockdown Lola, her name is, but it drags you out of the house, you know, and I put my sort of AirPod Pros on, listen to some music. I missed music. I was saying for a long time, as you get older, you listen to more speech-based stuff, and I've missed music a lot. I have amazing. I'm walking along. I probably look like a loony. I'm bouncing along, walking the dog, raining last night. It's seemingly dark, rainy, and quite cold, nothing to be glad about, but I was just bounding along with my headphones on.
That's
I was loving it, you know. So,
I do tend to listen to podcasts when I go for a walk myself, but I actually have my vinyl record player in my home office here now, and I have two metal cases of my old vinyls under my desk. And when I was allowed to last year, when I was able to go out, I was actually starting to add to the collection again, so that's one of the things I'm looking forward to doing when it's permitted, starting to pot around the secondhand record shops of Brighton and Lewes, because there's some fantastic. Very lucky. It's a good place to be a second-hand and vinyl collector, because there's some tremendous shops down here. So, topping up my old collection. I'm a bit eclectic. My main ones are Prince, The Who, and Bruce Springsteen. So a bit of a mix and match.
Yeah. Well, maybe at the end of the podcast, you just is it plugged in? Get one on. We do requests.
Russ certainly won't sing that much. I can absolutely promise.
Russ's requests at the end.
You're not here. Listen to me singing "Kiss" by Prince, doing that squeaky voice thing. I can assure you that just won't work.
Yeah. Do you know what intrigued me? And I thought I don't understand it.
Tell me.
When that GameStop thing happened, I can understand the.
We talked about it last week.
Yeah, the structure behind the short, the overshort, and being over naked, overexposed.
You asked me a brilliant question last week, and which was, how could you have more than 100% of the stock being held short at? And I went, well, I kind of thought to myself, "Buh," and then I went, well, it's because somebody's got a control bolster stake in the company. Yeah. But sitting and thinking about it, it still really shouldn't be allowed to happen. No. So in effect, it means that whoever's been doing the lending has lent the same stock twice.
Yeah.
Which is a bit naughty, or somebody just gone naked short, which is illegal. So actually, you asked a really, really good question, and I just assumed it was down to the guy's stake that he bought. But actually, you can understand why the Reddit and our Wall Street Bets campaign was launched against that, because neither of those practices is in any way acceptable, really.
Yeah.
So I can understand why they got upset. But equally, putting your money down just to make a point and trying to break, if they were trying to break the system, well, it doesn't look like it's working. If they're trying to make a point, they did. If they're trying to make money, well, not so much looking at it right now, unless you were very good with the timing, right? Because where is it now? 60 bucks or something?
Yeah, it's down 80% from last week, I think. But the thing is though, that the structure and the setup of that company was such that there were lots of shorts there, naked shorts as well. And, you can make it work. If you pump that price up, you could punish those shorts and they'd have to buy back the stock. And so you could have a rise. Now, they tried it with silver. And I thought, that's not the same kind of thing. You can't. Are people short?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand. I mean, because it's a massive market, silver, isn't it? It's huge.
I think the London Bullion Association put out a number that there's $29 billion worth of metal in London. And that's excluding excluding what the Bank of England sat on, presumably. So it's very different from shunting around a 1 to 2 billion cap stock as they initially were with GameStop. Mm. The silver miners did respond a little bit. We saw Hochschild and Fresnillo here perk up for a day or two, but it didn't last very long. And it is a bigger. I guess what they were looking at there, you've obviously got the. I don't know whether there's the arguments whether you want to call them conspiracy theories, that you have an awful lot of exchange traded funds that. Some are backed by derivatives, some are backed by physical metal, and there is a school of thought that there's been such issuance, such growth in the assets of these exchange-traded funds, that there isn't enough physical metal around in a hurry if everybody decided to actually, lay claim, as it were. So there is an argument there that there's, again, potential for a squeeze on physical metal. And that's, I think, why they were looking at that. But again, I think the markets that you're dealing with are just bigger, more liquid. And also, it has been tried before in silver with spectacular lack of success. You know, if you you may or may not remember Nelson Bunker Hunt and his two brothers, Lamar Hunt, who actually was responsible for the name Super Bowl, by the way. Apparently he came up with it, if you're an American football fan. And he actually owned the Kansas City Chiefs at one stage, or in the game on Sunday. But they tried to corner the silver market in 1979.
Yeah.
And they were incredibly wealthy people, were terrified by inflation because they had lots of cash, understandably. And in fact, Bunker Hunt is famous for a quote saying, well, look, almost anything is better than paper money because any fool can run a printing press, is one of his comments, which in the current environment is quite apposite, depending on who you think is in control of the printing presses right now. So they were to corner the silver market, and they drove it up from $7 to $50 in about a year.
Wow.
And then you got a lot of people complaining. Some complaining it meant that they were rigging the market. Tiffany's and jewellery companies actually complained that their costs had gone through the roof for reasons that were no fault of their own and were artificial. And so, surprise, surprise, as we've just seen, the regulators stepped in. And they stepped in to maintain an orderly market, and they stepped in to try and restrain the amount of leverage that was building up in the system, which you could argue to a degree is what we've seen with GameStop. So once the Bunker Hunts were banned from using more leverage to drive up the silver price, they stopped buying, and everybody else just sat back and went, okay, now what's going to happen? Well, we aren't buying, they aren't buying. Yeah. And so the silver price started falling. The banks then began to call in margin on the Bunker Hunts, began to sell their silver for them, and the whole thing went into reverse gear very, very quickly. In the end, there were some lawsuits. I think the Bunker Hunts had to pay some fines. And ultimately, their business empire collapsed under the weight of the debts that they'd acquired buying all this silver. They had to sell the Kansas City Chiefs, Bunker Hunts champion racehorses. The Bunker Hunts were cleaned out, and it took silver 30 years to get back to where the Bunker Hunts got it to. Didn't get there till about 2011. So it's been tried before, and it went wrong. So the precedents of history there, as to a degree they were with GameStop, not very encouraging, really. So yeah, I understand why it came onto their radar, because all of this talk of there isn't enough physical silver out there to meet demands from paper products like ETFs, but it's a much bigger market and very, very difficult to shunt around on a sustainable basis. Again, particularly if brokers are now getting more wary of taking on a lot of, you know, letting customers build up a lot of excess or a lot of additional leverage.
Let me ask you a question. You mentioned that cash is the worst thing to have there. And I heard the Bank of England saying yesterday there's going to be a 4.2% dip in the first quarter, but then a fast rebound in the second half of the year due to the vaccination program. But then they mentioned, didn't they, somewhere along the line, of negative interest rates. And I understand they have to mention this. And I thought, well, if that happens, if banks charge you to put money into the bank, then that will... straight away I thought Bitcoin, gold, that's the kind of places that will benefit if that's the case, right? Or the thought, the sentiment wise anyway, you know?
Yeah, I think markets have been positioning themselves for this threat for a while. And I'm not saying that cash is a bad thing. We all need to take it to Sainsbury's. They're not going to accept Bitcoin yet, and they certainly don't accept gold coins. So I think cash is a good thing. Having some easy set. I mean, any financial advisor will say, please try and have 3 or 6 months of cash lying around in your account, just in case, God forbid, you lose your job or you get ill or some dreadful development, and then you're covered. You've got time to sort yourself out. And from a portfolio perspective, it's a dreadful neologism, but it brings you optionality. It means that you have got options if the market has a wobble, because you've got cash ready to go to war with. You know, you are there in position to pick up some of those bargains that will undeniably be out there. So I think there's always a case to be made for having cash on account, because you're going to need it, and in your portfolio, but it's a matter of degree. And yet, if interest rates go negative, you're going to feel very uncomfortable owning cash, but it may still have its advantages portfolio-wise. There is so much debt in the system that this is effectively financial repression by central banks to try and help governments, and you can argue companies and some consumers, through the debt situation into which we've got over the last 20 or 30 years. The central banks have tried to cure the debt crisis of 2007-09 by encouraging more borrowing and trying to keep credit flowing, which is an interesting philosophical discussion in itself. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to make debt cheap, because so the debt, the globe's existing debts don't catch up with it, and they can use, try and get some fresh debt just to see us through now the pandemic. And this was the phrase financial repression was coined by two economists from the 70s, whose names I've forgotten. But then it was picked up by Kalman Reinhart about a decade ago. And they went through, basically, this. Their model was, of financial repression, was what emerging market central banks did during their own debt crises in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, so it'd be interesting to see whether this pattern is kind of repeated here, and whether we are indeed following the path of banana republics. I'm sure the Bank of England will thank me for saying that. But so the first step of financial repression is to take control of borrowing and drive interest rates and yields down. Tick, got that already. Borrowers are being helped, savers are being punished, particularly when you account for inflation. Even if it's very low right now, your money is still losing its purchasing power because inflation is higher than the interest rate. The second stage of financial repression is actually government and central banks start to lean on retail and commercial banks. Now, you might think, well, that's not happening here. Well, actually, it is. Through the coronavirus bounce-back loans and the CBILS and the CL bills, they're government-backed loans, but they're not on the government's balance sheet. They're on the bank's balance sheet, and the banks are being told, get out and lend and suck it up. And you've also just seen some government-guaranteed loans and trade finance provided through commercial banks to British Airways and EasyJet and Rolls-Royce. Mm-hmm. So the government is gently pointing the banks in that direction. So again, phase two, you can already see it. Phase three, no sign yet at all. We all know banks, insurers and financial intermediaries have got to own so much capital on their balance sheet. Well, phase three is that capital, the government and the central bank says, actually a big chunk of that's got to be gilts. You've got to own government debt, whether you like it or not. And the fourth area, if that doesn't work, is actually capital controls, and they ban cash from leaving the country, which is something that Thatcher and Reagan permitted again in the 1980s. So let's just watch how those steps go. But of the four steps, you've already got one. Well, we're moving into two. So just keep your eyes peeled. But yeah, it's a very difficult time if you've got lots of cash. And there is therefore the temptation to go hunting for a return in, well, bonds, maybe not so much now, unless you're going into junk bonds or emerging market bonds, or therefore equities, or therefore things like Bitcoin and things you might not have done normally. So investors are being forced up the risk curve, and it's turned cash into a bit of a hot potato, which is a difficult situation. But I think what I would say there to investors is, again, you need to have some cash kicking about. And also don't, I know that you are being pushed that way, but don't take on more risk than you are trying to avoid doing things that you wouldn't do normally, just because in the end, there will be a time when the market corrects, and no matter how low the interest rate and how negative the real interest rate, that might still look a better deal than a stock market going down 20, 30, 40%. Does that make sense? So there's, it's all relative. So do keep some cash around, because it will come in handy in more ways than one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny though, you talk about sort of returns, and when if people are not experienced and they're looking at, how do they get return on their money? I mean, they probably, a lot of people now have heard about Bitcoin. They think, how do we get some Bitcoin then? But I suppose what's harder, more complex, is to, for individuals who've not had any experience in the stock market, is to think about dividend paying shares. How do they get exposure to that? Reinvesting dividends is a good thing, a good return.
Reinvesting dividends is actually the secret source of long-term equity investing. Because it brings in compounding, and the maths are incredibly powerful, and you get that sudden, you get that hockey stick in return in your return profile after 7, 8, 10 years. But it does actually take that long. So for the real benefits to kick in, now you can do it through. I mean, if you're a beginner, a nervous beginner, probably the best way to do it is through a fund. I know you're then going to give away some of that yielding fees. But you, in return for the fees that you pay, you're going to save yourself an awful lot of time. So you can actually go and walk the dog or watch Coronation Street rather than sitting down at home at night reading annual report and accounts. And in theory, you will get the expertise of the fund manager. Mm-hmm. So that is, I would suggest, the best way of gently dipping your toe in. And you can do that through actively managed funds or passively managed funds, whichever you prefer. But if you really want to get stuck into it when you've developed your expertise, you can pick your own. And we've seen in the UK this week, we've seen five or six companies announce further year-on-year dividend cuts, like BP and Shell, although they were expected. And you've seen companies like Unilever announced increases. And actually, the most intriguing thing now is companies are beginning to restore dividend payments like Barrett, another FTSE 100 company. So I think unless something goes seriously astray with the vaccination programs and or the economy seriously double dips, it feels as if we might be through the worst in terms of dividend cuts and starting to see some green shoots in terms of dividend restorations, because restorations and payments are now keeping track, if not exceeding cuts, which is after the mayhem of the second quarter last year, is a good thing. So the FTSE 100 is probably offering about 3.6-3.7% yield right now. That's protecting you from inflation. It's beating cash and NS&I. But clearly, you're in exchange for that, you're having to accept greater capital risk. So, again, it's a matter of what you're looking for. But I mean, for example, if you're in pension drawdown, there is the theory that you don't worry about the capital value of your portfolio at all, because all you're interested in is the income exceeding or matching your outgoings. So you're not eating into your savings pot. So the theory there is, and you know, a kind of modern retirement theory, is if you know that you're spending X percent of your pot each year, you just 4%, I believe, is a sort of magic number. Then you try and make sure that that's the amount of cash that you've got coming in income, and you don't stress too much about the capital values. But then you've got to make sure, is the dividend safe? How do you do that? You look at earnings cover, earnings per share divided by dividend per share. You can look at free cash flow cover, and then you have to correlate that with the balance sheet. How much debt is there in there? Is there a pension liability? What's interest cover in the P&L? And how much slack do you have if, God forbid, you know, there is an unexpected recession or a pandemic? And we saw last year, the dividend yields looked incredibly good on paper, but the support for them from balance sheets and cash flow and earnings was thin. And as soon as anything went wrong, and all right, blow me, it was something spectacular that went wrong, a lot of dividends got cut. So again, you've got to look at not just earnings per share divided by dividend per share for the forward year or the last year, but probably over the last 5 or 10 years as an average to see how much wiggle room there is if something goes wrong. And so does it sound hard? It is. Does it take time? It does. Do you need some practice at it? Yes, you do. So if you don't fancy any of that, that's why the fund management industry exists, active or passive, to save you all the bother, but it will obviously cost you for the privilege.
Yeah. I would say get involved, you know. I mean, I'm afraid, but everyone I've introduced to shares and they've asked me stuff, they start off very passive and they generally get more active and they quite enjoy it. You know, it's just reading about stuff and learning about it. I've learned more just through investing than I ever have in schools or colleges.
Yep.
I just think it's an excellent hobby.
I wish more of it was taught there.
Me too. I always think that it's a crime. It's not. I learned stuff in school I've never reused since. Even in maths, you say long division stuff, I would never use that. Or even, angles of, odd named angles of triangles.
Angles of incidence, I believe, is one. Yeah,
I'm thinking, how about learning about investing in businesses? How about that? That's quite important.
My kids know what I do. They're rising 14. So I said, Dad, well, why aren't we talking about mortgages and credit card interest and compound interest? Yeah. Well, I just look and say, kids, it's a really good question, kids, and I don't actually have the answer, you know, but I wish it was part of the curriculum somewhere along the lines, because it'd be very, very useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I know exactly. Marvellous stuff. Russ, thanks for that, fella, and we'll see.
Enjoy walking
week.
The dog.
Yeah, well, again, I'll keep my headphones in and bounding along the pavement like a loony. Yeah, cheers, fella.
Off you go.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five. Argo Blockchain, up 3% and 99 pence, just shy of £1. At four, Supply Acme Capital, of course, non-mover because it's suspended, late accounts. At three, E Energy, non-mover, 13.5 pence. At two, BPC, down 10%, 2.05. And at one, Eurasian Mining, non-mover, 28 pence. Okay, top five most red RNSs. As follows. At five, Ascent Resources, Slovenia Update. At four, Argo Blockchain, Grant of Options. At three, Tizian Life Sciences, Director, PDMR Shareholding. At two. In fact, let's go down further. Escape Hunters there, sixth most read. Share Incentive Plan, very good that. You incentivize people to work for you. Just generally, the company improves. Invest in people. They are your greatest asset. And at one, Greatland Gold, block listing, 6th monthly return. Is that the most read there? Really, what? What? Most liked to escape hunt, by the way. But that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. By the way, Iconic Labs is there as well. One of the most read. Directorate Change. So check that. That's it. Anyway, have a nice weekend. Anyway, listen, all of you. And hopefully we'll do it all again on Monday. I say do it all again. All you have to do is listen, I suppose. Well, you're probably doing stuff, you're not just listening. That's it, you know. Lying there listening. I assume you've got busy lives. Even during lockdown. We're coming out of it in March, guaranteed. That's it. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.